The following is an interactive webinar presented by IntelliCure, the premier wound care documentation software. The topic of this unscripted, interactive webinar is Trends in Wound Care Audits and Charge Denials, featuring Dr. Caroline Fife and Dr. Helen Gelly with a live Q&A. It was recorded on November 19th, 2021.
Dr. Fife, Dr. Gelly, are you ready to go?
Thank you, Zach. And it's, Helen, it's a credit to you. It's late on a Friday, and there were over 100 people registered, which is a sad commentary. It means there's a lot of people who don't have a life, or a lot of people who are really struggling with audits, maybe both. And I'm excited that you can do this because you're one of the people I most admire. I don't want to make you feel awkward right before I ask you a bunch of questions, but you're not just a gifted and dedicated doctor, but you have been a successful businesswoman too. And that I think is what gives you the perspective on this, because it takes both a clinical and a business perspective to really face this issue. Lots of docs are good at one or the other. But you're also a wonderful person and always been very generous with your knowledge. And so I really appreciate you being willing to share it. And I am confident we will not get through everything today. There is so much to say. So I'm just going to get your commitment that we'll do it again, so that all the people who have questions are not panicking, thinking if they don't get a chance to ask their question, it's over. Almost surely this is part one. And rather than try to read a bio, because I always feel like nobody really cares, right? I think it would be best if you just told us how you got from emergency medicine to hyperbaric medicine, and then from hyperbaric medicine into the unfortunate business of understanding audit and payment issues, because I think that will help people understand how you came by this expertise.
Yeah, well, I was in academic medicine early on in my career, and academic medicine is much like being in the armed forces. Sometimes you get volunteered for things.
Yeah.
And most often when you're not paying attention.
Yeah.
So at a faculty meeting after a night shift, so I was not exactly at my best. we found out that George Cerny, who had started the hyperbaric unit at Emory, was leaving Emory because of some disputes in the operating room.
And he came to Houston, or he came to Galveston.
He was at Galveston first, then he went to Emory.
Okay. Got it.
But he then went to another hospital just north of downtown Atlanta to start another hyperbaric unit. But as you know, in academic medicine, whatever department originally holds that service line keeps that service line. And so ortho gave hyperbaric medical directorship to a hand surgeon. And Georgia Poison Control decided that perhaps a hand surgeon could not handle critically ill carbon monoxide patients.
Poison Control that said that. Isn't that interesting?
Yes. And they approached emergency medicine to find people who would train in hyperbaric medicine so we could take call. And because I wasn't paying attention, I was one of the three that got volunteered. They said, well, who doesn't want to do it? And I guess I didn't raise my hand. So the next thing you know, I was...
wants to do it. So yeah.
I just love to do it. So I did my 40-hour intro course at Caraway Medical Center in Birmingham, Alabama. And came back from that 5-day course, and 2 days later, I was doing an intubated patient at Pressure. So anyway, that's how I started. Because of a variety of factors, in 1993, I opened my own office-based hyperbaric medicine practice at a time when Medicare reimbursement was essentially zero for hyperbaric.
And we all thought you were crazy. We all thought you were crazy to do it. And you got a lot of grief for it too.
I did. But because I've never had less than two jobs, I continued to work in the emergency room and take critical care call till, I guess, 2010. For that long period of time, I ran the practice, did emergency medicine. We also took a call for critical care patients. So we would split the month 10 days at a time. But anyway, it was a great experience. I got to see things I would never have seen before.
Yeah.
And I think that it gave me a true appreciation of what is necessary to keep a practice going. So, for example, in the critical care arena, when we were doing it, you know, people would say, well, you're only going to get your hyperbaric payment. Well, that's not true. You can do, you're doing critical care, just like when I was in the ER. So we would bill critical care hours to try and offset the hours and hours that we were paying people to come in to be on call, right?
This was the university that you were explaining how to do the critical care billing, which presumably they should have known.
But they didn't. And I think that's part of the problem is that there's such, if it's a little bit outside the norm, they're not willing to look at it critically to say, okay, well, this could be a possibility. So as time went on, you know, I did, in 98, I stopped emergency medicine and devoted myself full time to office-based hyperbaric medicine.
Why did you open an office-based practice? I know that's not the focus of our conversation, but I know that there's nothing like being in an office-based setting to find the dirty secrets out about billing, because the problem with academics and even working in a big hospital system is that you're so removed from the billing process. You often don't know what's happening. In your private practice, you always know. But I am curious. It was a ridiculous idea at the time, financially. I'm curious why you did it.
Well, I made the first part of the move was because I was billing for hyperbaric supervision and the critical care hours to my academic program, but they wouldn't allow me to buy down my time because they couldn't track what my billing and collections was. Well, as you know, 99183 is one very unique code. And they should have been able to do that. And when you're up all night and then you have to work the next morning pulling a 12-hour ER shift, it didn't seem fair that I wasn't getting my time bought down. That was the first part of it. And the reason I opened the office practice was because I had been negotiating with one of the hospitals for 18 months to do a joint venture with the hospital to open a hospital outpatient department in their hospital. And after about 18 months, the CEO walks in and says, "We can't do this joint venture. You're a doctor." And I said, "Are you kidding me?
Yeah.
You've known I've been a doctor for 18 months." I was so PO'd. I said, "You know, screw you. I'm going to just do it." And if I knew then what I know now, I might not have been so cavalier. But, you know, emergency medicine is sort of do one, see one, teach one in the wrong order. So that's what I did. I just opened up the office practice.
It reminds me when I was at Parkland, I spent more than a year in the ERs at Parkland in Dallas, and the surgeons used to tell me, "Caroline, don't just stand there. Do something even if it's wrong. Whatever you do, don't just stand there." So you and I are on a committee for the Undersea and Hyperbaric Medical Society that has a very long, awkward name. You gave it an acronym so we could remember it. But we've been trying to understand denials for years in that capacity, although you're the brains of the operation. And I know we have a lot of people worried about Medicare recoupment, which as far as I can tell is happening because it's the only thing funding Medicare. The Medicare trust fund is bankrupt. The only money they really have is the money that's coming back in from recoupments. So there's a lot of pressure to do that. And there is such an alphabet soup of auditing organizations. It's, you know, a topic for another day. But I think I'm curious how you developed this painful expertise. And then after we think a little bit about what kinds of audits are going on, maybe we can talk about some specific ones that we know are happening right now, because I know that's on the mind of everybody who's listening.
Yeah. So after you invited me to be co-chair of QORC, That I think was in 2012 or somewhere around there. But in 2014, CMS asked the AMA RUC to reevaluate the pricing for 99183. So the AMA RUC does evaluations of physician work and practice expense for items that appear on the physician fee schedule. And because 99183 was on the physician fee schedule, that was the code that had exceeded the 500,000 claims mark. So it was marked for audit. It had not been reviewed in decades. And they tried to approach a number of different organizations to help defend the code. And it ended up in the lap of surgery and emergency medicine. And emergency medicine's subsection said they recommended that I be the expert witness for the AMA RUC.
Honestly, you've been the perfect person, but the fact that emergency medicine subset at the AMA knew you has really saved our bacon, because I don't think people really quite understand what was at stake. Since the code hadn't been reviewed before, we could easily, this is the physician supervision payment, but we could easily have had what, a 20, 25% cut, just because nobody was explaining what was involved.
Right. And so in the process of doing that, of figuring out, I mean, there's a process that you go through, and Surgical Society did all of the analysis work, and emergency medicine provided a secondary expert, or at least someone who represented them. And when we went to present with the RUC, we had gone through both the physician work component and the practice expense component. And the practice expense component is all that, it covers all of the things that when you walk into your doctor's office, the structural things, the staffing, the lights, the equipment. And CMS has a very comprehensive list of all of the items that you can use in an office setting, and they have a price list for them. So surgery did that because they're pretty good at that aspect of it. And then what we learned the first day was that they thought that we did nothing. And that's when I called
supervising
you.
Supervising the
hyperbaric. Right, supervising the hyperbarics.
Yeah.
We and when I called you and said, we need, like, right now to know how sick our patients are, how many meds they're on, how many comorbidities they have.
I remember you were basically in the middle of that meeting, and this is a big shout out. Thank you to all of our IntelliCure clients, because IntelliCure clients submit data to the U.S. Hyperbaric Registry. And because of that, we had the data structured in a way that allowed us within, I think, about 3 hours to give you the answer to the average number of comorbid conditions and the average number of medications that patients took. And we wrote that up in for the UHMS. If people are interested, I can send it because it was open source. But I think we found there were, what was it, 10 comorbid conditions and 12 meds or something
right.
like that
right.
on average. And these are not, you know, minor things. They are major cardiac, renal, diabetic things.
Yeah, pulmonary, all of that.
Right. And so that was a big aha moment for them, that the patients we see are very sick and thus high risk.
Right. So, and it was to sort of give you a sense of where they were during the meeting, which is a very high tense, sort of very stressful time. One of the physicians asks a question. He says, Dr. Gelly, why do you use that much oxygen? And you know, I could be very snarky at times, and I really bit my tongue. I wanted to say, what, we should give them helium? You know, like, what gas do you, you know, the amount of gas we use is oxygen, because it's hyperbaric oxygen. And at that moment, I thought, you know, we are sunk.
Yeah. Because they don't understand even the most basic thing about what we do.
Right. But it ended up that we only had about a 9% reduction in the physician work, which was excellent because it was slated to be more than double of that. And then they had a practice expense, which under normal circumstances would have just been added on to the 99183 for site of service 11 or 49. But when CMS got this, they made the independent decision to remove C1300, which was the code that was used by hospital outpatients departments for hyperbaric therapy facility fee, and give it a code G0277, and the G codes are billable across all lines of service. So that meant that it would be on the physician fee schedule and it would be on the OPPS schedule. So that came out of the blue. But I think,
and that was how many years ago now?
It went into effect 2015.
I mean, that tells you, to me, the message I got from that is that CMS has a very long range, thoughtful approach to payment policy, and that long ago, they were anticipating changes in the hospital-based outpatient department. That's what that tells me.
Yes.
That's a pretty stunning thing to realize. Like, presidential administrations change, CMS head may change, but all of the people who are doing the work are the same from year to year, and they follow a path all the way.
And they are aiming towards site neutrality. And that site neutrality is not really focused on hyperbarics and wound care necessarily, but on the cardiology practices, where on one Friday, the echo was $200, and the following Monday, after they had been acquired by a hospital system and designated HOPD, was $800.
Yeah, in case people miss that, you got a private doc. Cardiology is the big thing here, and is a private office. It's like, I'm in an HOPD, but downstairs is my cardiologist, who's in size service 11, private office. And hospitals were going in, buying those practices and turning that doctor's office the next day into a hospital-based outpatient department that then had a physician fee and a facility fee. So the services weren't changing, the quality wasn't changing, the equipment was the same, but now it costs more than twice as much.
Oh, sometimes four times as much.
Yeah.
And so that's their target.
So CMS was then saying, okay, we got to stop this. And the only way to do it is to say, we're not going to pay differently for different sites of service.
Yeah. But when
they haven't done in the HOPD yet, but that's
right.
The message.
Well, it's coming. But anyway, so in 2015, when the new physician fee schedule came out, G0277 on the physician side was an absolutely brand new thing. And so our practice, which started dropping the G0277 code, was in a 100% prepayment audit for 9 months.
Wow. So just to be clear, you would treat a patient, submit a bill to Medicare, and not get paid until you went through an audit process.
Correct.
Which took months. Okay.
Months. But during that process is when I started to learn more and more about how these audits happened. What you needed to do to be successful in overturning their, you know, denial, essentially. Sometimes they would switch to post-payment denials.
Yeah, I was in post-payment for a year.
Yeah. So they would have paid you already, but then they decide they paid you incorrectly, so they want their money back.
And they want their money back first, and then you fight to keep it.
Right.
Yeah, you can write the check, and then you deal with the audit. Yeah.
Right. And so talk about a nightmare. If that patient is no longer in service for them, and in your practice, they start taking money out of random people's Medicare reimbursements.
Oh, wow.
So
before I forget, you know, a lot of people don't know the year I was president of the UHMS, the first year was the most horrible year of my life. And it was 98, I think. and CMS just without the ruck, like they just decided to not pay the physician supervision fee. So lots of people don't know in 1998, the physician supervision fee went to zero overnight and they cut the facility fee by 75%. So all I did that first year was try to keep us from not existing anymore. And so it's not like these challenges haven't happened before, but at the time we were completely unprepared, like as a UHMS. I mean, nobody knew what you do. We didn't have connections. We didn't understand how Medicare worked. We didn't know that you could go to your congressman. It was really a trial by fire to try to figure out how things work. But you're absolutely right that you don't figure it out until you have to. So I think one of the points you were making is that you went into private practice, and in dealing with all these audits to keep your private practice alive, you learned about audit response, because most people listening are in hospital-based outpatient department. And when Medicare audits the HOPD, they go after the hospital because that's where the money is. You know, just like Willie Sutton said, why do you rob banks? Because that's where the money is. The bigger payment goes to the hospital and they know they can just write one check. So I don't know that the process is different, except maybe it is. Is the process any different?
No, because I've had the unfortunate experience of being medical director for a number of hospital outpatient departments, and not unfortunate because of the departments, but because of various audits. And one of the things that experience actually brought to my attention in a very forceful way is that most hospitals will write off a claim that's denied for less than $500. Well, at the time that I was doing this, hyperbaric therapy, 4 units, was less than $500. So every denial they got, they would write it off. Well, if you're doing 40 treatments, that's not just 500, it's 500 times 40. And then the other problem, which I learned, unfortunately, about is that the medical records department are the ones that get these letters. And the medical records department is in no specific rush to get the information. They don't know what information to send. And so you have a window. It's, you know, it varies on the different levels, whether it's 45 days or 60 days or 90 days.
Depending on which audit you're getting,
and which level of appeal you're in. And you need to know what your parameters are. You know, somebody would sit on somebody's desk and then they would submit the information late. Well, once you submit it late, you've lost.
Yeah, I'm sure people would like to know, because you've talked about this at various meetings where you've said this kind of audit, this is how many days you have on the first round, how many days you have the second round. I don't know if there's a resource we could give people after so that they could just have an understanding. So Zach, hold us accountable that afterwards we'll make sure people get whatever resources they need. But there is an explanation of how many days it is for each one. And it's probably not things we want to spend our time on right now. But I also found out it's not necessarily the medical records department, because when very widespread audits began in HOPD with Medicare, I was expecting it. And so I was calling the medical records office weekly saying, has anybody called for records? Are we good? No, everything's fine. And then as I told you, months later, I get a call from the hospital corporate office, which is in a different town, that those requests went to corporate. And so corporate had been working this denial with the same problem that you'd said they didn't know what to send. And the example I remember once you texted me a picture of the stack of Xerox papers that you were sending in, because they don't deny a course. They deny, you know, March the 5th, and then they're going to deny March the 8th, and then they're going to deny, you know, April the 12th. And they want to know the rationale for why hyperbarics was started. So you have to send the medical records people or whoever just thinks, okay, we're going to send the hyperbaric note because it happened. That's not what they're asking. They're auditing whether it was medically necessary. So you have to send the initial H&P. And sometimes more information than that, but you have to do it for every single one they're denying. So it ends up being this gigantic stack of papers just to try to salvage you know, odd treatments here and there. And of course, my, you know, corporate officers are very nice people. They had no idea. So my director at the time, Cheryl White Wolf, and I had gone to the corporate office and met with them and said, look, you got to tell us when you get these. But it was a constant process of proactively trying to find out what was being audited. And I would say most physicians who are in HOPD probably don't know if the hospital is being audited unless someone has come and asked for their help.
Yeah. So what we did was we had a checklist. So every denial had to get the H&P, which you need to read before you send it.
In case it says something stupid.
Yes, very stupid.
Yeah.
My favorite one was somebody was actually a adolescent who didn't drink, and we said didn't put anything down, not doesn't drink. We just didn't put anything, and it read drinks an unknown amount of alcohol per day.
Yeah,
kind of thing. So it's like, oh, we have to change that.
Yeah.
But you know, you need that, and then you need to have a packet that either a review article somewhere in the indications handbook, the indications.
You mean the UHMS committee report?
From the UHMS committee report, where you actually highlight. You have to remember that these people have very little background.
They're not medical medicine.
A lot of them are not medical. And so what you have to do is go through and say, here's where they had radiation. Here's where they had this. Here's where they had that. One, two, three. And then you put it in the record. One, two, three. So you can see where they have to look to see that everything that was put on this list is reflected either in the medical record or in the requirements for payment. And then you have to know that, for example, the standard audit, which is redetermination, that's the first level for which you have 60 days, goes to a different section of the same MAC contractor.
And for people listening, I think probably everybody knows the MAC is the Medicare administrative contractor,
right.
But there are 10, there used to be 13. I can't remember how many there are now. They're trying to get to 10. I'm in Novitas. I forget where you are.
I'm in Palmetto.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, and if you fail on that level, then the second level of appeal is reconsideration. And then that goes to a qualified independent contractor. So it is not the same people, the same MAC. It's a different organization. What people don't know is that at that level, you have to send in all the documentation that you are ever going to need. If you fail at this level, then you go to administrative law judge, and eventually you can go to a district court, federal district court. But all of the evidence that you can submit has to be submitted at this reconsideration level.
So if they need an A1C and you don't have it in the chart on that second round, when you get in front of the law judge, you can't say, look, here, I found it.
Right. Supposedly. You know, you probably could, but you're not. But they say that that's it. That's all the evidence that you're going to be that you will be able to use. So at the reconsideration level, you really need to have your medical director involved, because they need to pull review articles, opinion pieces, any sort of seminal studies that need to be presented, because all of this,
and you're sending every single request. So if there's a patient and they've questioned 15 things, you're going to copy that packet 15 times.
Correct. And it's a lot, you kill a lot of trees. Some of them are allowing now uploading of things electronically. A lot of them at the QIC level are not. So once you get there, hopefully you'll get most of them resolved. But if not, then you go to administrative law judge. And the thing to know about the administrative law judge is it's a layperson. And I have had really excellent results at the administrative law judge level. For example, we had all of our chest x-rays and blood sugars denied for hyperbaric patients because they were not medically necessary.
And that was the determination that it wasn't medically necessary to get a chest x-ray or blood sugar on somebody in hyperbarics.
Correct. Yeah. Well, when we got to the administrative law judge, I said, look, if they have blebs, and this was in the old days before CT scans. You know, that's the only way, that's the only screening test I can do. And if they're diabetic, I need to know what their blood sugars are, and there's no other way. And he said, why are we even here? This is stupid. And he reversed all of it, right? So they're lay people. So you know, you can actually present common sense things.
Except by that time, you may have gone 18 months without being paid.
Correct.
Have paid money back and been waiting 18 months to get it back again.
That's right. But yeah. Every penny counts.
Yeah.
Every penny counts.
Had a really good experience. The one time I've been to administrative law judge, it was very early in my career. I didn't even know what it was. I was just like my clerk who later became in the C-suite at the hospital. We were learning together as young things. And she said, you know, there's this process and you get on the, this is, I mean, in the 90s, you get on the phone with someone, right? So I did this in the 90s, even, you know, we all think it's telemedicine now. It's like, well, I was on the phone back then. And actually I did the same thing. I said, this is why we do this. And he said the same thing. Yeah, this makes total sense to me, fine. And the amounts of money back in the 90s seemed like a lot of money then. It would be laughable now. But you know, I was also an academic faculty, and one of the dangers of being in academics or on a salary is that you can be lulled into the sense that it doesn't matter because it's not your money.
Right.
But my chairman, on the first week that I was running a program, my first job out of fellowship, did me the great favor of being a jerk and said, let me explain to you how this works. If you don't make money for the hospital and for the department, I will fire you. So, I totally understand what you said, sir. Like, I got it. So that was a gift, as it turned out. As we're talking about denials, you're the person who first showed me that some of the MACs will post on their website the list of their reasons for denial of hyperbaric oxygen therapy. So talk a little bit more about that and why people need to know what region they're in. And that, by the way, the doctor and the hospital could be in different regions. That can happen too, but they need to know who their MAC is and pay attention or subscribe to the listserv so they can know what policies are out there. It's a surprising amount of information.
Yeah, the list for denial codes is out there. We can send you the link, however we're going to do it.
And is that just one MAC, or will they all use the same denial code?
Well, there is a generic denial. The code list is generic. But how they apply it varies from MAC to MAC. So there are a number of different levels. When you look at the audits, some of the MACs, especially Palmetto, will actually give you the results of their audits or of their targeted probe and educate audits. And they'll tell you why these claims were denied. And the most common is there's no signature from the doctor for that day of service, which means the doc didn't sign the note electronically. That there was the incorrect diagnosis was placed on the note. But the worst one is that no notes were sent, which means you had an opportunity to get paid, to, you know, pass the audit, but you didn't even bother to send the notes in. And the fact that in the second round of TPE, and especially in Palmetto, there were the percentage of denials based on lack of the evidence of the documentation being submitted was higher than the first round. I mean, that's an own goal, right? Unforced error. The problem is that when you look at them, and we had COVID, actually was sort of a godsend because they stopped TPE, they mm-hmm. stopped the RAC audits.
TPE stands for Targeted Probe and Educate, in case people don't know.
Yeah, they stopped all of those, and most of them were in the second phase. So the third phase never came to fruition.
I thought they picked them up again. They didn't just pick up where they stopped, left off, or do they just say, never mind, and we'll just move on?
I have no idea. I have not heard. They started back September 1. But the thing is that after the third round, if you don't pass, then they can refer you to a RAC or a ZPIC, or I mean, there's so many of these, you know, where actually some of these can put you in jail.
Yeah.
You know,
the recovery audit contractors, you know, put out a list of their topics for the year, and hyperbaric oxygen therapy was on the topic, I don't know, 2 years ago, but I don't know if you're getting feedback from people who are getting audited. And by the way, for those of you who are listening, Helen and I are always happy to review things, not that we're trying, that we're available indefinitely to help. I don't want to volunteer her, but we try to find things so we can warn other people. So, you know, one of the things I discovered in my audit was instead of auditing 20 patients, which they're supposed to do, they'll audit 20 sessions of the same patient. So if it's a hyperbaric, let's say it's a hemoglobin A1C that they didn't find on the chart. If I didn't get the hemoglobin A1C on the chart, there's going to be the same deficit 20 times, right? Because it wasn't in my H&P, and apparently if I didn't record it, like you're toast, because all they're going to do is say, and again, and again, and again. It's not really, they'll say that's a statistical audit, but that's not how that works, right? So that's another way you can really lose your shirt. And the other horrible lesson that I learned back when I was in academics was, you know, big hyperbaric facility every Monday, I'm policing the diagnosis codes to make sure they're correct. A couple years go by and somebody comes in and says, well, we're shutting you down. You know, it's a big multi-place academic facility. We're shutting you down because we can't get paid. I'm like, whoa, whoa, whoa. What happened? So to unwind it, MD Anderson was sending us their radiation cases. I was getting four new ones a month for times years. And I was recording them appropriately with the diagnosis of late effects of radiation, and the hospital coders were changing them to hemorrhagic cystitis. So without my knowledge, they had changed them to a code that wasn't covered. And we were getting denied, even though I was doing my part to make sure the right code went in. So that's another thing that I had no idea, that somebody that I don't know, that I don't even talk to, will change something in my documentation that I never see, and then virtually ran the program down because of that. That's another terrifying reality that I think people don't realize can happen.
And the other thing is that in the hospital outpatient department, the ultimate arbiter of what gets chosen as a code is not the physician who does the evaluation, as Caroline said. And we had one series at one of our hospitals where we were coding for, again, late effects of radiation, and they coded it as a sunburn. Well, a sunburn is an effect of radiation. Unfortunately, it's not covered for hyperbaric oxygen therapy. And so, you know, and then you say, why? Why did you pick this? Well, however somebody had worded it in the consult, mimicked more closely the language for sunburn.
They probably said there was radiation damage with redness or something.
Right.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
They coded it for that. And so you have to be aware of who is getting the ultimate responsibility for the coding, because little things like that really have a significant impact.
We have a lot of hands raised.
I want to
give the rest of the time for questions, because I think that might be easier. But maybe before I do that, I just want to get a sense from you is how big of a threat is this? There are enough people on this meeting to tell me that people are worried. But, you know, it's hard to get a sense of whether everybody's getting swept up and the people who aren't worried about it just don't know. What's the scope of this that we're talking about?
You know, if you look at the Palmetto tells you how many providers they looked at, and the numbers are relatively small, 20, 30.
Is the provider the hospital or the doctor?
Well, we think it's the provider of the hospital. But the hospital may be the one getting audited, but remember, a lot of the hospitals are billing 99183 for the physicians. So it's the 99183 that's getting audited in some instances, but the hospital is the one submitting the charges because they're employed by the hospital.
Wow.
So it could be both. but the numbers are not that great, but when it happens to you, it becomes just a time suck.
It's consuming. Yeah. It becomes your part-time job.
It's always looming, and you don't know when you're going to be the next one.
Yeah. So Zach, you're going to help us deal with questions. I think there are a lot of them. Helen, we can just wind her up and she can keep going. I have questions that I was going to ask, but I think they're adding up. So there's some you want to read, or do you want to?
Certainly. As a reminder, folks, if you have a question, click the little hand raised button there. You should see it on your screen, or maybe wiggle your mouse around and then it'll appear. You can click on that to raise your hand and we'll call on you. But there was a question submitted by Maria Barker. It's a long question, so bear with me. Specifically for wound care, has anyone had success with real-time authorizations for procedures performed in a hospital outpatient setting? We plan to do one thing on the patient's next visit, but when the patient presents and we don't see what we're expecting, we need to approach differently than what was pre-planned and get a new or updated authorization. Any input would be helpful, specifically for Maryland.
Now, Medicare doesn't require pre-authorization. Medicare Advantage plans do, private payers do. So I'm going to assume that this is about Medicare Advantage or a private payer. And that's a very, another big, big mess there. Because in my experience, unless somebody's dying, they take 3 days.
Right, 3 days.
And there's not much you can do about it. In fact, they've also got the Nancy Reagan approach of just say no. There are lots of things, Helen, you and I have talked about to try to get into a real-time authorization situation, but so far, nobody's had the will to try to pursue them. So,
right.
Yeah. And I'm not aware of any way that you can get authorization faster than 3 days unless somebody's life is on the line. And even then it's questionable. Okay. Well, hit us again, Zach. You got anything else to say?
No. I think that's right. I think when people are asking the question, I think they need to identify, is it for traditional Medicare, Medicare Advantage, or commercial plans? Because they all have different requirements.
Sure.
Because the next thing I was going to mention was Medicare Advantage and the struggles. The idea that somehow Medicare Advantage is implementing Medicare policy is foolishness. And we've mostly been talking about hyperbarics just because that's sort of how you and I first got, you know, hit in the face with this. But I got an email from a doc not that long ago that 100% of their cellular product charges had been denied and they weren't even going to use cellular products anymore. And when I look at my requirements for documentation on cellular products, there's 24 elements that have to be in the note of things you have to specifically say are there or not there. And so, you know, that you have to really know what your requirements are, which maybe is another important point to have, make sure that people know that they read the LCD for either wound care or hyperbarics and have an understanding of what's required. So I was asking about Medicare Advantage because it's a different kettle of fish, but I think, Zach, that I saw that you were gonna unmute Dr. Charish because he had something to contribute.
Well, first off, thank you to both of you. It's a great conversation. I'm looking at a Medicare RAC report to Congress in 2019. Where overpayments collected were $162,029,369.15. Mm-hmm. So these are real issues that, you know, you're preaching to the choir, which is good, but we need to pass that along to a lot more people. That's all I have to say.
And all suggestions about how to do that are always welcome. Helen and I sometimes get some time on the UHMS annual meeting schedule, but it's always so depressing that they would rather not have us on the schedule. So, David, that is one reason we thought, hey, well, try this as a way to distribute information. And if it works, then poor Helen's probably going to be committed to this. And you too, if you're willing, just to make sure everybody understands what's going on. Because I think the frustration that I feel both for cellular products and for hyperbarics, and I know we got denials on debridement too, is that they start to look for gotcha phrases.
The
one you and I saw was that they were denying hyperbarics if you didn't say the patient was treated in a hard-sided chamber.
Right.
I did a fellowship in this and I never had to write that down. And there is no way that you would know that they think that's a requirement unless you find out that somebody didn't get paid because of it. And we know why it's happening, because there's inflatable chambers out there and they're billing hyperbarics for inflatable chambers. But the idea that they would deny because you didn't say something that you've never had to say in the past, it's just so ridiculous. And it starts to feel so impossible.
And I had a TPE of 40 chart review, and they denied one of my cases. I was still under the threshold, but they wanted us to pay back $60,000 worth of hyperbaric treatment. And when they said that, you know, we don't treat soft tissue necrosis of the bowel. And I said, neither do I. Can you show me in my medical record where I said that? So it wasn't anywhere, because I'm very, you know, anal retentive when it comes to that. Reviewing from page one to the 450 other documents we sent them, nowhere did it say soft tissue necrosis anywhere. Not in the nurse's note and not in my note, not in covering, you know, hyperbaric doctors and supervision. And they said, oh, well, I guess you're right. I said, not only am I right, but look at the quality of life indicators and the articles. And, the, you know, I went through the whole thing. This was at the a third review, right? And at the end of that, they said, well, Dr. Cherish, you did a great job. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
But so this was, I didn't mention anything that was wrong. In fact, I did everything correct and they still gotcha, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, there's a question from Constance about, Caroline, this is your bailiwick, but there's a 29445, which is application of a cast, total contact cast, I imagine. And then 97597, which is selective debridement. And the NCCI edits obviously say that they can be billed separately, but as you and I both know, Medicare seems to think that anything you put on a wound or an ulcer after debridement is a Band-Aid. So, I mean, we bill and we put it like towards edema or towards whatever. Sometimes it's bundled, sometimes it's not. And it seems to me relatively random sometime. Do you have any input on that?
Yeah, so for what it's worth, you know, I'm co-chair of the Alliance of Wound Care Stakeholders, and I just a few days ago, as you know, Helen, there was a discussion on our call about a presentation that had been done by the Alliance members on this NCCI edit issue. So I suspect that the written response about it's going to be posted on the Alliance website, but at least there are lots of people trying to tackle both the issues in the NCCI, because you're right, it ought to be okay, and yet it isn't. So it does feel like there's some capriciousness in how they implement those edits. So at least there's a concentrated focus on it. Whether we ever get it fixed or not, I don't know. But you can thank the folks at the Alliance of Wound Care Stakeholders, because they're tackling it with the APMA and lots of other organizations really hard. So...
Total contact cast is a pretty expensive Band-Aid, is all I have to say.
Constance was asking, can we appeal for payment? And I think my answer is you can always appeal. Yeah. Yes, absolutely. You can always do that. Because, you know, they shouldn't be exclusive. And it's easy to explain that they were directed at different types of problems, one at the neuropathy and the other at the wound. But
you have to make sure that you code the neuropathy and point the cast to the code.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a really good point. Right. Yeah. Yeah. I can't see if there are any other questions out there, but I always have some questions about whether or not, how worried doctors need to be, because a lot of times physicians will say that, you know, the hospital has to do a payback for whatever reason. Maybe there's nothing wrong, but the hospital didn't defend themselves very well. Can they come back and ask for the doctor's portion in the HOPD? Have you seen that happen?
I have not. And I think it's because they're paid out of two different silos and they don't talk to each other. So
we should thank our lucky stars that it's too complicated for them to figure out.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a blessing. And the other thing that popped into my head is just recently you also track, when somebody asked about Medicare Advantage, you know, those are the private payers implementing their thing. And you recently found information, I think it was on Aetna, what Aetna was defining as nutritional evaluation. And so I don't know if you want to talk about trying to keep up with the privates, because, you know, I never thought I'd see the day that Medicare was going to be the easy thing. Like, at least there was one entity, and there might be 10 max, but at least it was kind of like one entity. Now there's however many private payers have a Medicare Advantage plan. It's very overwhelming. So how are people supposed to stay on top of that?
Well, they really should be pulling the coverage, the medical policies for all of these plans, for the commercial plan, as well as the Medicare Advantage plan.
Are they usually posted online? Can you get them?
Yes. But for example, some of them are not. But for example, a United will just, in hyperbarics, will just say, well, we just follow the NCD. That's their reference. But what you really need to know is what they do in their on the commercial side. Because
they really just apply their commercial policy. That's really what they do.
Right. If it's the commercial policy is more restrictive or less favorable, otherwise they swing back and forth. But for example, the nutrition, I mean, we've all been arguing about how do we define a nutritional deficit? How do we address nutritional deficits and in the wound healing patient, and what is their caloric requirement, etc. And, you know, we argue about should be albumin, prealbumin, transferrin, whatever, XYZ. And, you know, we've been trying to figure this out, and they just decided, well, you just have to have an albumin. So you have to have an albumin. That's it.
There you go.
Just get it. And so most people, when they get seen by their primary care physician, will have a total metabolic panel, yeah, and there will be an albumin thrown in there. You just need to document it in the chart. Now, how we really address the problem of the patient, either through nutritional screening for malnutrition, or, I mean, there's a grip strength thing that I've
been doing the Nestle M&A, and right. I'm stunned at, you know, I always thought I was pretty sensitive about nutrition, but when you actually screen people, it's extraordinary how many of them you can miss, because yeah, overweight people are malnourished too, if you look at the criteria. I see a hand up, Zach, and we've only got a few minutes left.
I just wanted to understand Constance's question. So I had always been under the impression that if we did a debridement, say on the left leg, and then we did a total contact cast on that same leg, we couldn't bill for both. So am I understanding that as long as the diagnoses for the two procedures are different, then we can bill for both?
So you're supposed to be able to. It depends on which edits that it gets, but you're more likely to be able to do it if you use a cast for the neuropathy and bill the other procedure for the wound. That's a better strategy. Although the problem that we see is that there doesn't seem to be a consistency in how anything is handled. But it's an approach anyway. Helen, you look like you're about to say something or unsure. No.
No, but there is variability. Also, same patient, same codes, same diagnosis, same pointed to the same diagnoses, and a different person is processing the claim, it will get paid differently.
Yeah, I just saw Michael Crash put up a comment that the NCCI edit doesn't take the diagnoses into consideration. But I think part of the goal is to have charting that you can defend. Go back to if you want to appeal it. So there may be some utility there, but fingers crossed that things will go. There'll be some improvement after the fantastic presentation on NCCI edits by the Alliance. I think I still see one hand, and we've only got like 3 minutes left. So,
hi, this is Yesenia. Can you hear me?
Yes. Hi, Yesenia.
Hello. I have one comment and one question, or actually two comments. We have found, I work for 3M, we have found that when we verify benefits and we're calling a Medicare Advantage plan, many of the reps, the customer service reps at the Medicare Advantage are quick to point to their commercial policies, and we usually will have to escalate the call to a supervisor to remind them that they're bound by Medicare guidelines. And so usually after a couple of minutes or after a couple of times of escalating, and they can require prior authorization, but they should be following Medicare guidelines. So I just wanted to remind everyone of that, to be persistent.
Thank you for bringing that up, because you're absolutely right. They are supposed to follow it. So, yeah. And you had another comment, I think.
I did. And so the other comment, going back to a comment that you made, that it depends on the person at the insurance company who's processing the claim. Two exact claims, same diagnosis, same procedure codes, can be paid or denied different depending on who's processing the claim. There are wonderful automated systems out there that will help detect that, so it's not such a manual process. One was developed in San Antonio by an anesthesiologist, now part of Experian, but that will help find those, because as you mentioned, Dr. Fife, you know, if your claims or your audit department has a criteria to write off anything at $500 or less, that might be $500 times 30 or 40 mm-hmm. times, that money adds up. So there are great software tools out there that will help automate some of those denials, that you can catch them early so that you can appeal them in a timely manner.
And of course, one of our challenges is lots of times our department is small and the hospital's really busy with the ER or the OR, not that focused on what's going on with us. So, but thank you for those comments. I can't believe we've used up an hour. And I'm fairly confident that there will be enough feedback to plead for you to come back and tackle some of these other things, because I still have like 6 things on my list, Helen, of things you and I have encountered that are worth talking about. And I have a feeling that you'll add to it. So I want to thank everybody for hanging in there late on a Friday afternoon. Helen, I really appreciate you. You've been my hero for my whole career.
Please.
And that remains unchanged. And
only following behind, trying to fill your footsteps.
So I hope everybody will have a great Thanksgiving week. Great. And maybe the auditors will take the week off too.
Yes. But
we can always hope. Thanks for your help, Zach. Thanks, everybody.
Thanks, everybody.
Bye-bye.